You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Grevet.
Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Grevet, your host today. At Food Integrity Now, we envision a healthy, sustainable world. A world where our food is nourishing and our mind, body, and spirit can thrive. If you share this vision, go to our website and join us. My guest today is Dr. Don Huber. Dr. Huber is an award-winning, internationally recognized scientist and professor emeritus of plant pathology at Purdue University. His research over the past 50 years has focused on the epidemiology and control of soil-borne plant pathogens. He is a highly regarded scientist, and today we're going to be talking with him about the effects of GMOs and pesticides on the environment and human health. Dr. Huber, welcome to Food Integrity Now.
Oh, thank you, Carol. It's an honor to be on your program.
Well, we are honored to have you on our show. And it seems like more and more information is surfacing on the effects of GMOs on human health and our environment. But that being said, there are still many people who don't know about GMOs. So I'd like to know what you would say to those people who are learning about GMOs for the first time.
A simple description of what's happening with GMOs would be to describe it more like a virus infection than it is a traditional breeding program or gene transfer. In other words, what's happening is we have an artificial means of transferring nucleic material, genetic material, in from a foreign object entity into a plant or an animal, another living entity that would not normally occur in the environment or in nature.
Okay, and why is that of concern to you?
When we disrupt the integrity of the genetic code, which we do with genetic engineering, there are literally thousands of changes in gene expression that occur then because we upset the normal regulatory mechanism for gene function. Genetic engineering is really a process based on flawed science that we had to modify or even abandon much of that basic theory with the sequencing of the human genome. Our current understanding of genetic function is that it's based on the spatial relationship in the of the nucleic materials relative to the environment. So you have two major factors as well as the actual nucleic material that are going to determine what products are produced, what toxins are produced, or what remediation the body and the entity will employ then in either limiting or localizing those damaging aspects so that they don't become a lethal entity. So there are literally thousands and of changes that occur when you throw in a piece of or insert a piece of new genetic material to disrupt both the spatial relationship and that spatial relationship with the environmental controls that would normally take place.
Okay, and another concern is that there really have been no long-term safety studies as to the safety of GMOs. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. The only two long-term studies have been The Seralini study, which is the only lifetime experiment, and the other one would be the study of Carmen and Bleeger on the 5-month study with the pigs from weaning to fattening. Both of those studies demonstrated very serious health consequences from both the new proteins that are produced in the entity, in the genetically engineered organism, as well as the disruption of the integrity of the normal genetic code.
Okay, and have there been any studies by the biotech industry?
There have been 4 studies, very short-term studies. The longest is 30 days. And in most of those studies, it's not clear that they even had a verifiable, valid control, so that we're not sure even the validity, but they're very short term. We know that most of these genetic materials, genetic engineering, aren't acute toxins, but that the products that are produced or even the insertion of the nucleic material can be extremely toxic on a chronic basis. In other words, an everyday basis. So it's more like a tobacco situation than it is a cyanide situation. But all of the industry studies have been limited to an acute toxicity evaluation, which would be more like testing it for cyanide toxicity and ignoring the fact that over a longer period of time, these toxins can be very accumulative and also extremely damaging as they disrupt our own genetic function.
That's interesting about the acute toxins versus the chronic toxins. So my understanding, an acute toxin would be something that was lethal right away, and a chronic toxin would be something that over a longer period of time would cause some sort of effect or disease or something like that. Is that accurate, or can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. Yes, that would be accurate. It's kind of like, I guess, a classic example that many people are familiar with is the thalidomide situation. Certainly not acutely toxic, or it's not acutely toxic, but look at the tremendous damage, especially to developing embryos on that exposure to the thalidomide. We were protected from that in this country primarily by the exercise of the precautionary principle requiring adequate safety testing before that was used. That principle seems to have been discarded by our regulatory agencies when it comes to genetically engineered crops and also the products that are either applied to those crops or produced in those crops themselves.
Okay, on that note, let's talk about glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. Glyphosate is not just an herbicide. Can you tell us what else it is?
Glyphosate was first patented as a very effective chelator to bind metal ions. These would be mineral nutrients that we require for our physiological functions, things like iron and manganese and zinc and copper, cobalt, all of those entities. But it was first patented as a chelator. That chelation with the type of chemistry that you have with glyphosate is a very unique type of binding. It's about the same strength as other chelators that we use in a positive manner, like EDTA. But with glyphosate, it when it binds the metal, it doesn't turn loose of it, so that it's no longer physiologically available to perform those essential functions in the body or in the plant. That was its first use. As a result of its powerful chelating ability, it was then patented in 1974, 10 years after it was patented by Stauffer Chemical as a chelator, as an herbicide. The herbicidal activity is based on its strong ability to immobilize those mineral ions that are required for enzyme function, so that it turns off physiological pathways in the plant with glyphosate. One of those is the shikimate pathway, but it does that by binding mineral elements that are essential for enzyme function. Now, more recently, in 2000, Monsanto also patented it as a very potent antibiotic. So that we have over 300 million pounds of glyphosate used indiscriminately as a very potent antibiotic, but it's an antibiotic against the beneficial organisms that we require for proper digestion, proper GI tract function, and also for mineral and vitamin production and assimilation. So it has, because of its chelating ability, that ability to totally immobilize essential minerals, it can shut down many different pathways in animals and plants and bacteria and humans. It's much, much more than just an herbicide or just a chelator. When you disrupt the normal biotic system, our ecology, whether it's in the intestinal tract or in the environment at large, you have a tremendous change in nutrition, in health, in disease, and all of those aspects we're now seeing manifest with the indiscriminate use of glyphosate as it's promoted with the GMO crops.
So it's interesting because many people are concerned about the effects of antibiotic use in raising animals. And I think a lot of people don't know that glyphosate is a patented antibiotic.
Yes, a very potent one, but the 29 million pounds of penicillin and streptomycin and tetracycline and those antibiotics that we're using are generally used because they're active against a pathogen, a disease organism. The difference with glyphosate is that it is active against those organisms in our GI tract and the environment that prevent those pathogens from being a problem to start with. So that glyphosate is extremely toxic to the beneficial organisms as an antibiotic, and it takes almost 4,000 times the concentration of glyphosate before it even starts to touch any of the pathogens. So a very powerful antibiotic, but in the wrong direction for us, and used extensively not just in agriculture, but in waterways and roadsides and all kinds of other uses, because you can buy it everywhere and we're told that it's such a safe chemical, don't worry about it.
Right. And you can go to Walmart and buy it. You know, you can pick it up anywhere. So most people understand now that DDT was and is toxic, but they know little about glyphosate. Do you think glyphosate is as toxic or even more toxic than DDT?
DDT is a pittance toxicity-wise compared to glyphosate. Samsel and Seneff, in their second paper, concluded that glyphosate is probably the most toxic environmental chemical we have ever had. And that, again, is because of its effect on nutrition, its effect on the entire biome that we rely on for survival.
Wow. Well, understanding that the toxicity levels are so high in using glyphosate and how it impacts our microbia, do you see any appropriate use for GMOs?
GMOs, or genetic engineering, is a very powerful potential technology. Our understanding of what we're doing is very primitive at this time, and that's why every individual genetically engineered product has to be evaluated separately, because we don't have enough knowledge of all of those changes that take place in the genetic system when it's disrupted, so that we can draw general assumptions. And that's why safety evaluations must be made on each individual conversion or individual genetically engineered event as it takes place, because no two are the same. And without that safety testing, we're playing Russian roulette, just playing with the health of our children and future generations, as long as we remain in this massive experiment that we call genetic engineering, without establishing that research to determine its safety and proper utilization.
Well, that is not being done, as we know. So have we come so far that it's going to be too late, because none of the safety testing has been done, and we, in essence, are the human guinea pigs?
I don't think there's any question but what we're already seeing the consequences of that. We've pretty much sacrificed an entire generation of children. But the longer we go, the more the damage is going to accumulate. So that if you look at the predictions for autism, one of two children being autistic in 2025, you look at what's happened just over the last 18 years of genetic engineering, and you see how all of those major modern diseases are reaching epidemic proportions now, and all of them have an epidemiological track or curve that only fits genetic engineering and glyphosate. So that I don't know that we're to the point of extinction in any regards, although if you look at the decline in fertility, maybe that's coming. But certainly we are damaging our future and our children's future with this massive experiment, without recognizing that there are downsides to any scientific advancement, and we can use those advancements only as we recognize the downsides and compensate for them.
Yes, and now Dow Chemicals is promoting its new crops genetically engineered to be resistant to the toxic herbicide 2,4-D, a chemical which has been linked to cancer and reproductive problems. What can you tell us about this herbicide?
Yes, again, it's a much milder effect than glyphosate. Glyphosate in the long term is even more damaging than 2,4-D. We know of the damage from the phenoxy herbicides, and they were restricted in their use. When you have genetically engineered crops that are herbicide tolerant, you no longer have limitations on exposure because those chemicals then are directly in our food. There's no way that you can avoid them if you're going to eat that food because they're systemic in the plant. They're not just on the surface like our typical herbicide or typical ag chemicals would be, so that you can wash off many of those. But in your genetically engineered plant, 2,4-D and glyphosate and glufosinate, those materials are all become systemic so that they accumulate in the parts of the plant that you eat. You can't wash them off and you can't avoid them. When you start adding 2,4-D along with glyphosate, you have two compounds that have similar activity on the endocrine hormone system. That's your pituitary and thyroid and reproductive hormone system and brain function. But the activity becomes synergistic and compounds the damage of either one, so that it's not a matter of just the sum of the damages, but you have essentially a totally new compound effect anytime you combine two chemicals. We see that also with just adding the adjuvants, the surfactants that they use with glyphosate. When you add them to the glyphosate, it can become over 1,000 times more toxic than if you had either one of those chemicals alone. And so the same thing with 2,4-D, or with dicamba, or the other materials that chemicals that EPA has approved for genetic engineering use. So it becomes much more serious, both from a carcinogenicity standpoint, from a developmental standpoint for the fetus or for the child. And at the same time, then, we're doing all of these other things that would further compound it through our early vaccination programs and those things that we're trying to get a response to from the vaccination, for instance, that the glyphosate shuts down that immune response through its antibiotic activity on the gut microflora.
And yet, many people think GMOs are safe and are needed to feed the world. And I think it's mostly because the biotech industry has done something very similar to what the tobacco industry did. And now what I feel that the plastic industry is doing, and that's creating confusion through their deceptive marketing practices.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm convinced that's their intent, is to provide that confusion rather than the light and truth that's necessary to make a proper evaluation.
Yeah, and as a scientist, what do you want to say to those people to clear up that confusion? I just think that, you know, the whole higher yields thing, that's just not true. You know, the feeding the world, that's probably the number one thing that I hear. But we need these if we're going to feed the world.
Well, it's false to start with that we've never had a genetically engineered plant that's increased yield. All of our increase in yield has been through traditional breeding.
Mm-hmm.
The objective of genetic engineering, as it's commercialized, is for proprietary control, not to feed the world.
And what do you mean by that?
They're not breeding genetically engineered plants for higher yield. They're not looking at the photosynthetic efficiency. In fact, everything they do, and when they disrupt the integrity of that genetic code, decreases the ability of the plant to capture that sun's energy and store it as sugar and make proteins and other essential elements for feed and food, so that none of those aspects, the physiological pathways that would bring about an increased yield and quality, are even on the planning or on the drawing board for genetic engineering, because our knowledge isn't good enough. We don't know enough about those multi-factorial situations like yield or quality to even know where to start. So everything is focused on very simple single gene type of activities, or very few genes. And again, for proprietary control, for patenting, not for commercial benefit, or not for consumer benefit.
I'd love for you to share with our listeners about the letter that you wrote to Tom Vilsack, who's a secretary of the USDA, and what happened with that. Can you share that with us?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The letter was very private. It was a confidential letter alerting the secretary to four entities or four items that I felt he needed to be aware of if he wasn't, and to request his assistance then in releasing or giving approval for USDA personnel and facilities to be allocated and available to do much of the research that was essential if we were going to gain the critical information we needed in these four areas. One of them was on safety of the GMO crops, the some of the aberrations and changes that were becoming very apparent were not being addressed in any of the research, and USDA scientists who had the capability to do that research were prohibited from doing it. So that I wrote the letter to alert the secretary to those items and to request that he not dig the hole further and deeper until we had the research on the impact of genetically engineered crops on our food security and sustainability, as well as production efficiency. The letter was hand-delivered because I didn't want it compromised in the mail. However, even though it was a private, confidential letter to the secretary, it was leaked, actually in fairly short order. A couple of weeks after it was written, it was on the internet and went viral at that time. But and as a consequence, then I did write a follow-up letter explaining why I'd written it, because I didn't put the details in that letter anticipating that risk management and the secretary would be contacting me for further information. That information was provided to them when I was contacted, or to risk management personnel. Names were given, research data was provided. However, there was no follow-up on their part. And so five of us got an appointment, met with top administrators of USDA, shared with them about 135 peer-reviewed scientific papers and the data that was accumulating relative to infertility in animals, as well as the overall safety aspects that we were concerned about. Again, to request that support from USDA. We didn't meet with the secretary in person. We met with the senior administrative personnel, however. They were polite and courteous to us, and that's as far as it went. Mm-hmm. So we didn't obtain the support or And in fact, the scientists that we had asked for permission to do the research on the safety were denied that opportunity to participate.
Were you surprised by their lack of response?
I was, because at the time I was chairman, the APS coordinator for the USDA's National Plant Disease Recovery Program, and also I'm a long-term member, about 40 years, on this nation's Threat Pathogens Committee. And I thought, especially after our trip to Washington, D.C., and the opportunity to meet with the top administrators, that there would be a positive response, a desire to get to the bottom of the issues and to quickly develop the epidemiological information and research that was essential to understand what we were seeing happening then across the face of agriculture and the nation. Again, quite disappointed. I wasn't surprised that many vindictive types of threats and response from industry and academia that followed the release of that letter, because that's happened to everybody that's raised a concern about GMOs. So I felt honored to be part of the group there.
Right.
That someone would pay enough attention to it or feel that their cash flow was threatened enough that they had to do some of the things that they're doing, as you see now with several bloggers and some of those that I guess it gives them a chance to vent their frustrations in not being able to take away our First Amendment rights and cover up scientific evidence totally.
Right. So what are your thoughts on colony collapse disorder?
Colony collapse disorder in bees is an interesting phenomena, very serious because of its impact on food production, as well as just the environmental impact that has on biodiversity and everything. It's characterized by three conditions. One is the bees are malnourished, especially for micronutrients, for manganese and cobalt, B12, and zinc, and copper. Those micronutrients, those are the same micronutrients that we're becoming very deficient in. The second is that there is plenty of food available in the hives, but the bees are dying and leaving because they can't digest it. Bees have an obligate requirement for two bacteria in the honey crop or the bee stomach in order to digest the protein and the pollen, and also to digest the honey and use it as an energy source. Those two bacteria are extremely sensitive to glyphosate at very low concentrations, at about less than a hundredth of the concentration that we're finding now in rainwater and even sometimes in the atmosphere, are toxic to lactobacillus and bifidobacteria, so that the bees are starving because of the antibiotic activity of the glyphosate that destroys their ability to utilize that food reserve that they've accumulated. The third characteristic is disorientation and disruption of the endocrine hormone system, which both glyphosate and the neonicotinamide insecticides can bring about. Both of them disrupt the endocrine hormone system so that you have, again, a compounding effect with the neonicotinamide insecticides and with glyphosate. But glyphosate impacts all three of those conditions. For one thing, pollen and plants are much lower in their micronutrient availability, so that there's less micronutrient available for the bees from a nutritional standpoint as they're foraging. Then you have the antibiotic activity, and then you have the endocrine hormone disruption and other aspects, so that when the bees leave the hive, they're disoriented, they're not able to get back to the hive, and they die pretty much more from starvation than they do from anything else. Now, when you take those two bacteria out of the bee stomach, you also remove its immunity to many of the other diseases and pests. So you have the rhinomyte, you have European foul brood, you have the virus diseases, because you have a bee that's extremely weakened and is there with a bad case of AIDS without those bacteria to protect it and build up its immune system. So I think we'll see it's a multi-factored situation, but we'll see also as research continues to develop, and we see glyphosate in the honey, we see it in the pollen, we see it in the bee at levels that are much higher than would tie up the nutrients, the micronutrients, and destroy the gut microflora. So I think it's a matter of just connecting the dots a little closer than we have currently, but we'll see, I'm sure, a very close tie to our indiscriminate use of glyphosate in the system with colony collapse disorder.
Well, thank you for that explanation. That was wonderful. That really makes a lot of sense, and I've never really heard it articulated quite that way. So thank you for sharing that. Just recently, I saw a preliminary paper that stated that glyphosate was found in human breast milk. Have you seen this information?
I have. That information was shared with me, and I appreciate it. It should send up a red flag to every individual of what we're doing or what the potential is, and the need for some immediate research. We can't just sit back any longer, because the impact is of those levels that were found in breast milk indicate two things. One is it indicates that glyphosate is a bioaccumulator in the body, because the levels are quite a bit higher than found in urine. So that it can be a bioaccumulator, much like DDT. And also, the levels are 100 to 1,000 times higher than is required to kill lactobacillus and bifidobacteria and enterococcus, those beneficial organisms that every individual has to have if they're going to be healthy and productive citizens, because our gut microflora is tied to brain health and to our physical development through the vitamins and minerals and hormones and amino acids that our body can't produce on its own. We rely on that synergistic relationship with those organisms. In order for a baby to develop that healthy microflora that would prevent it from having autism or any of a number of other very serious health conditions, it has to have these organisms available to it, and the primary source for an infant is through the mother's breast milk. It contains those organisms, or it should contain it, and yet these levels of glyphosate are many times higher than the toxicity level as an antibiotic against those organisms by the glyphosate, so that we have deprived that child of its basic immune functions and its nutritional functions when those organisms are not present. The other thing that happens is that in the absence of those organisms, those beneficial bacteria, then you have your pathogens like Clostridium and E. coli and Listeria and Salmonella that all become active to fill that void in the GI tract, and we end up with those situations where we see the fatality from, or the lethality of, the Clostridium bot toxins that brings about sudden infant death syndrome, and we have all of the other toxic relationships that develop because of that dysbiosis, or that change in the gut microflora because of the antibiotic activity of glyphosate. Now, at the same time that we're trying to immunize that infant against a lot of these diseases of that small child, we're pouring in the antigens, and if they don't have those organisms in the intestinal tract, their immune system is compromised. They're not able to respond adequately to the foreign antigens that we're adding in the vaccines, and can actually do more damage than good without that opportunity for the child's body to respond properly in the absence there.
Wow, it seems like there should be an outcry from the public because of this. I mean, what you just described to me is it's more than a red flag. It's scary.
Well, if you look at the data and the CDC graphs that Dr. Nancy Swanson has put together, it's a train wreck. And we keep responding by putting an ambulance at the bottom of the hill rather than the fence at the top.
Yeah, that's a good analogy there. So I know that you have to deal with dissent and doubt within your own ranks and the challenges of your own colleagues. How do you deal with that?
I've learned that the purpose of science is to find the truth. And if you're telling the truth, that's what you're supposed to do. If the GMO and the glyphosate were so safe, I can't understand why the companies would deny the opportunity to do the research. They do everything they can to prohibit it by denial of access and also by intimidation and threats. And yet, you would think for their own good, they would want to have that information available to them.
Well, obviously they don't. And I think it all has to do with greed. But I really thank you very much for all you've done and continue to do to provide us with evidence to counter the biotech company's propaganda, because that's what it is. And you certainly have the credentials and the studies and the science to back up all this information. So we really appreciate you for being a guest on our show today and sharing this information with us.
Carol, it's an honor to share with you. I appreciate your willingness and invitation to be with you today.
Oh, well, thank you. It's our privilege to have had you on the show. We'll look forward to further studies, and I think the truth will prevail.
We certainly need the labeling people need to have a choice and know what they're eating, especially when you have so many unknowns tied with both the chemicals in our food as well as the totally unique and new proteins and allergenic materials that are also present.
Thanks again, and keep up the great work you're doing. We just really appreciate that.
Well, thanks, Carol. Good luck to you, and I appreciate your sharing the word.
Okay, we will continue to do that.